We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From Illinois Public Media, this is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Dr. Paul Lindy says when he's not at work, he loves his job. At the same time, he says his work is a grave but wonderful challenge. Dr. Lindy is a psychiatrist, and his workplace is a psychiatric emergency room. He describes the work as trying to soothe the jangled nerves of the weary, the sick, and the stressed. The latter category often includes the staff. He says working in psychiatric emergency services can be compared to diving into the swirl of a cyclone and hanging on for dear life. Paul Lindy, who is our guest this afternoon, has written a book about his experiences as a psychiatrist. The title, Danger to Self, on the Front Line with an ER Psychiatrist. Listeners, I invite you to join our discussion this afternoon. I look forward to your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call or by email. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Dr. Paul Lindy is clinical professor of psychiatry in the School of Medicine, University of California, San Francisco. He's the author of a previous book of Spirits and Madness, an American psychiatrist in Africa. He's also written articles for periodicals, including the San Francisco Chronicle, San Jose Mercury News, and Double Take Magazine. His new book, Danger to Self, is published by the University of California Press. And you'll find our guest, Dr. Lindy, online at www.paullindy.com. And his last name, Lindy, is spelled L-I-N-D-E. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, and will-talk.illinois.edu. Dr. Lindy, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Hi, Celeste. It's my pleasure to be here.
Yeah, good to talk with you. Well, the first sentence of your book is, I love my job when I'm not there. And then a short while later, you quote an anthropologist who wrote, treating psychiatric patients can be a nearly impossible task. What led you into the field of emergency psychiatry?
Well, there's really two different aspects to the question. I mean, the first part is really what I figured out along the way after working here for almost 20 years and now writing a book about my experience. I've kind of figured out the psychological reasons for choosing this. But at the time, it's all the way back to 1992, I was finishing my psychiatric training at UCSF in San Francisco. And at that time, I was really looking for a job that would provide me some time away from the job. The real advantage for me was very practical, the fact that I could work 2 or 3 days a week and get, you know, my work done in 12-hour blocks. It was very appealing because it gave me time actually to have to write. I mean, this interest in writing goes back all the way back into my teens, in fact, and it was a real practical decision, more so than really having a drive to do this kind of psychiatry at the time. I just wanted to have time for the rest of my life.
Yeah, but eventually you found that it's really the only work for you.
Yes, that's true. I mean, I've done lots of other psychiatric jobs. I've done inpatient psychiatry. I've done consultation psychiatry, which is working in a medical surgical setting and consulting to other doctors. I've done the outpatient office practice as well. And this is probably the best fit for me overall. The thing I really like about the job at this point is I work with some really fantastic people, both psychiatrists, nurses, social workers, people who are really a lot of fun and very down-to-earth and flexible, but also at the same time compassionate, very intelligent. And when I come to work, I sometimes think it's like walking onto the set of Cheers, that it's, you know, people you know well, and you get really warm greetings, and, you know, we really try to make the job as fun and tolerable as possible. So it's a lot of fun to come to work. In addition, it allows me to kind of open up my personality to my patients in a way that is a little harder to do in an office setting. In other words, you know, when you're seeing somebody in private practice psychotherapy, usually there needs to be a bit of a detachment to do the work properly. And here, with the kind of patients most that I see, who are really most of them intensely suffering and kind of lost and forgotten in many instances, I can actually put myself out there, my personality out there, and be who I am, which is kind of a bit of an extroverted kind of a person, in that I can be a real person, I guess, and that actually goes a long way. So I've found that this environment really suits my personality well, and I really enjoy my workmates. And so I really kind of fell into this by accident. You mentioned my previous book. I worked in Zimbabwe for a year in the mid-90s, 94, 95, and I'd already worked in psych emergency for a couple of years before that. Mm-hmm. And when I was looking at jobs, my wife's a pediatrician who was doing pediatrics there. We really could have gone anywhere in the United States. We were going to move back to the States, and we really decided to come back to San Francisco because we liked it, but I decided to try to get my old job back. Which fortunately I was able to do. So, I mean, I kind of went all the way to the other side of the world and still came back to here. So there's a certain addictive quality, I think, to this kind of work. And I think other people who work here will say the same thing, that there's a certain buzz to it that other jobs just aren't interesting or stimulating enough. So, I mean, I can say I did come from the other side of the globe back to the same job. And I'm, you know, this is now... I guess I came back in 95. This is now almost 15 years later, and I'm still here. So it must still work for me.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that comes through in the book very clearly is your feeling for patients.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to do that to be in this work and do a good job. So how do you engage with patients? What's that like?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It's not necessarily that different from how I would engage if I met somebody on the street who was a regular person, quote unquote, or a normal person. I guess I'm, you know, kind of have an openness about me, and I actually think a fair amount of it has to do with being from the Midwest. And so I'm always pleased to, you know, to talk to folks in the Midwest. I grew up in Minnesota, went to undergrad there, and I went to med school at the University of Minnesota, and I've been here now for 22 years, I guess. And I was just back in Minnesota on book tour, and I spent, you know, a lot of time going back to my undergrad, which was St. John's, which is in the middle of Minnesota, and I went up to West Central Minnesota. And, you know, there is something about the Midwestern temperament. It's a real phenomenon. I think when you're there all the time, perhaps you get used to it and take it for granted. But believe me, when you move to a place like California and the East Coast, I think maybe even more sharply, you get a sense that what you bring to a different place, you do bring aspects of your upbringing and your personality. And so I tend to be fairly open and friendly with people. You know, and obviously I don't, if they're going to bite me, obviously I, you know, withdraw. I'm not that, you know, I'm not masochistic. But, you know, I tend to approach these people as people, as they are. And I realize that they really feel sometimes they're in a one-down position. So here's a physician in a hospital teaching setting approaching them. And I think, to me, that bit of kindness and openness, you know, I think goes a long way. And part of that is very practical. It's like if someone doesn't feel threatened, they're less likely to be assaultive. And, you know, probably a quarter of the patients I see have a lot of paranoia, and paranoia to the point they might be assaultive, that they feel under attack. So for me to come at them, you know, sort of unassuming, friendly, open, I think actually I've developed that even further since working here, that it's a way to not get assaulted, you know, which is important. So I dress very casually, as do the other people I work with. I mean, I have nice slacks on, but I have a flannel shirt. I don't wear a tie. I don't wear a white coat. So, you know, it's you approach people respectfully, quietly. By the same token, if people are kind of wound up, I mean, I can actually sort of get wound up with them, you know, not inappropriately, but, you know, it's sort of matching their affect, so to speak, that people who are a little bit manic, I can get slightly manic myself. And it's, you know, that's sort of second nature. That's kind of how I'm programmed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, it just happened. I fell into this environment, happens to be a good fit for my temperament and personality.
Sounds like a mixture of empathy and sympathy.
Yeah. I mean, that's the undercurrent, is to be helpful, you know, and in a way it's kind of, you know, there's a service aspect and it's almost a ministerial aspect. I mean, obviously I'm a physician, I'm a psychiatrist, I'm Western trained, whatever that means. And so I do need to take care of the technical aspects. I mean, I need to figure out what's going on medically. I need to figure out what's going on psychiatrically. And I need to choose treatments accordingly. So it's not like I throw all that out the window. I mean, I still am a technician on a certain level, but I find I can be a technician on the one hand, but what really works with patients is just being genuine and, you know, being myself. At much more mileage out of that than being, you know, a technician.
Yeah. Would you tell us the story of the patient you call Sal Poletti?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so this happened when I was a resident, so early 90s. I was a third-year resident here at UCSF. And in your training, you get outpatient evaluations, and at least back in the day then, we would do 3 or 4 sessions to do a full assessment of somebody, you know, before presenting it to my supervisors and my colleagues. So it's like anything else in life. Sometimes you get a joker from the pack. And this, you know, basically, this patient was someone referred by his primary care doctor, you know, for anger management issues, essentially, on paper. So this patient, I had a very small, cramped office. This patient was in my waiting room, and I went to get him, and he didn't say anything. He was just very quiet as I brought him in my office, so I didn't really suspect anything until he got in my office, and he sat down briefly, but then he jumped up, and I had sat down in my chair, and he started tapping the walls kind of systematically. Every wall in my office, he was going up and down, tapping his knuckles on the wall, and at first, I just thought it was strange, but then as he was doing it, I saw he was hyperventilating, he was getting, you know, really agitated, almost even sweating, and he was sort of ramping up. I could see that, and I really didn't know what his intention was with this behavior, and I kind of started to panic because he seemed so unpredictable to me, and, you know, of course, I don't want to get hurt, and I don't want him to get hurt, so I started to get that feeling of, like, you know, I might be in danger here. So rather than, you know, go through my rote plan of introducing myself, I mean, I really just on a gut level said, hey, you know, are you, Mr. Poletti, are you okay? I mean, you seem really jacked up. And he was able to sort of stop the behavior momentarily. And, you know, then I'd say something like, of course, a long time ago, you know, you seem like you're really wound up. Can you sit down? Can we talk? What's, you know, what is going on in your mind right now? And he was able to sit down and calm himself down. And, you know, the way that I interacted with him was really, again, consistent with, you know, my personality and temperament. I just sort of tried to calm him down. And fortunately, he was able to calm himself down and kind of come out of what almost seemed like a dissociative state. I mean, he was somewhere else kind of in his mind when he was doing those things. And then in the course of conversation, he essentially, one of the first things he said is, I'm planning to kill my boss. I mean, he said very little except that. And he then gave me the details of how he was going to do it. And he was planning to create a car bomb and blow up his boss's car when the boss was leaving the workplace. And this patient had actually been a combat veteran and knew how to do it. And actually, this was pre-internet, but he knew how to build a bomb. And he had actually gathered all these different elements to build a radio-controlled car bomb. So he's someone who plausibly could have done this. It wasn't someone high in the sky. So the law in California, which came out of a case in the 80s called Tarasoff, Tarasoff, the law is that this is one instance where you can break confidentiality if there's possibility that you might be preventing a homicide. And so legally, I could actually have contacted his boss to let the boss know, hey, do you know that this guy wants to kill you? And I really hadn't decided whether I was going to do that or not. But when I told him, actually, about Tarasov, it was the strangest thing. He actually said, sure, I'll tell you his name. I'll tell you his phone number. And so he gave me all this information. And then I said, you know, I mean, I could legally contact him. And then he said, well, if I do this and I get in trouble and go to prison, you know, you'll be the one who will have told somebody. So, I mean, he more or less then threatened me to say, you know, if anybody finds out about this, you're the only one who knows. So I'm in this conundrum in the moment. And, you know, basically I want him to come back to see me again. So, you know, we were able to sort of get off that spot. And I basically said, listen, if you're going to threaten me, I can't see you. You need to see somebody else. And so that actually calmed him down. And that's kind of the reality check. It's like, okay, you've come here today. You know, you must have some ambivalence about doing this or else you wouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. And so he actually calmed down to the point that, you know, he agreed to get rid of his bomb-making stuff. He agreed, actually, I gave him a bit of medication to help with insomnia and anxiety. He agreed to come back early the next week. And I made a decision, since he seemed to be sort of cooperative, to not call his boss. And so subsequently, I got supervision about it, and I got all these different messages. I mean, one very conservative supervisor said, hey, you needed to admit him, you needed to heavily sedate him, you needed to call the boss, you need to call the police. And then another supervisor said, you know, I think you did the right thing. You know, otherwise he never would have come back if you would have done all those things. And then in the long run, he may have ended up doing it anyway. So I was fortunate, and I was, you know, I was scared because it's a pretty dangerous situation. I mean, I was fortunate in that he actually did come back early the next week, and only then did he tell me he was planning to trash my office. And what he was doing when he was tapping the walls, he was looking, trying to figure out where the studs were, because he was planning to use his fist to punch my office out, and then to use whatever he could find to trash my office. And he said also that he might actually, you know, assault me as well. But that he said, you know, there's something about your manner and the way you talk to me that I decided not to. So it was kind of an affirmation that, you know, that I might have some sort of knack for talking to people who are in that agitated of a state of mind. And, you know, I was fortunate. I saw him several times after that and got him on treatment. He got rid of all his stuff. He actually ended up going out on a disability for several weeks, and, you know, got out of the situation where he was away from his workplace where he wasn't going to kill his boss. But, you know, it's basically, I was really not prepared to take on a case like that, but that's sort of the nature of life, is you get things sort of thrown at you and you got to deal with them.
Yeah. I was surprised to learn this from your book, that according to the American Psychiatric Association, 40% of psychiatrists are assaulted during their careers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this raises the question, maybe we can talk about this, you know, who is the self referred to in the title Danger to Self?
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, there are multiple meanings
levels to
that. Yeah, so the initial level is Danger to Self is the technical legal terminology for suicide risk. And then certainly being a patient can be dangerous as well. So those are other selves there, being in a setting like this. And then, you know, obviously there's danger to mental health care professionals who take care of patients. You know, no matter what your license or your training is, this applies to psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, master's level therapists, you know, anybody who works with this population, is that there is a potential danger of being assaulted. And those figures are a bit old now. They're probably about 10 years old, and I don't know what the updated figures are, but, you know, of people who work in settings like inpatient psychiatry, it's probably a higher number than that, than 40%. And, you know, I've been, knock on wood, I've been very fortunate. I've been lunged at a few times, and I've eluded patients who lunged at me, and I've certainly had things thrown at me, and have been able to elude those, and I've never, you know, knock on wood, I've never, you know, received a punch. But You know, most of my colleagues here have been punched before. Not that I'm doing anything better. I think it's good luck, and I'm very, very cautious at this point. If I think someone is at risk, I just remove myself from the situation if I feel like someone's going to do that. But, I mean, the other level of danger to self, I think, is, you know, the emotional toil that doing this kind of work can take on a person.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, for me, sort of the self meaning, you know, why did I choose this profession? Why do I stay in this profession? And I think that the writing the book actually led to this sense of personal discovery. I mean, people who go into psychiatry tend to be programmed that way anyways, to try to figure those things out. And, you know, I've had years of therapy, you know, cumulatively over the years, I've had several years of psychotherapy. But the book was kind of screaming to be written on an unconscious level, and probably the main reason was to try to sort out, you know, why do I do this? And, you know, what basically what's the benefit? Why would anybody choose to do this? But also what, you know, what are the downsides as well? And so, yeah, the danger to self is multiple levels, and, you know, potentially being assaulted is, you know, when I'm here, it's a day-to-day risk, but I'm very cautious, actually.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Paul Lindy. His field of practice is emergency psychiatry. He is the author of Danger to Self on the Frontline with an ER Psychiatrist. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. You can join us with a phone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Toll free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. And by email, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. What is the state of the public mental health care system in the U.S. today?
Well, I would say that public mental health care in the United States is in crisis, no pun intended. And I've had colleagues say here in California that the system needs to be put on a hold, a 5150, for being dangerous to itself and gravely disabled. You know, my sense of that is that just as other sectors of public health care and other, you know, look across the board at public aspects to our lives, that the budgetary pressures have become very intense. And I'm sure Illinois is, as every other state in the United States, California particularly, in a sea of red ink, that, you know, cuts do need to be made, it seems. And to me, it's hard for me to say that public mental health care has taken a disproportionate cut. I don't really know those figures, but I do know that the cuts have been coming down the line. And my sense of that is that it's because, partially because, the patients that we see are among the most disenfranchised people in our society. And unfortunately, I think the patients historically that we've taken care of over the last 30 or 40 years, a lot of them have ended up homeless, incarcerated, or victimized. And with the state hospitals closing in the 60s, a lot of those patients, there were funds that were supposed to be delivered to take care of these patients in the community, and the funds really never got transferred. In other words, the state hospitals got closed, and that the money didn't make it to the community mental health. And so I think a lot of those patients ended up on the street or ended up incarcerated. So I'm not saying that the state hospitals were necessarily worth saving in the way they were configured. There were certainly huge problems, but there was this sort of dumping of people out onto the streets. So nowadays, in fact, maybe you've heard this quote before, but the L.A. County Jail is the largest mental health asylum in the United States right now. That, in other words, L.A. County Jail is taking care of more patients than any state hospital in the United States or any other forensic system. And the point is that the most seriously mentally ill, being in those kind of settings is suboptimal, and that, for example, in California, at least 20% of the prisoners are thought to have serious mental illness, 20%. So it begs the question of whether, and that costs money, of course, and, you know, the mental health care in the prison, there are competent people delivering it, people with good intentions. I mean, it's not necessarily horrible care, but it certainly is not optimal, and it's not free either. So it begs the question, how much money are we really saving if you look at police costs, if you look at medical emergency room visits, if you look at prison and jail costs? You know, really, are we saving money by treating the seriously mentally ill in prison and in jail as compared to trying to treat them in the community? And, you know, I think it's not. It's penny-wise, pound-foolish. And so I just think that there's that whole pendulum has really swung in that direction that, in my opinion, you know, the funding needs to get better for public mental health care, not just because it's the right thing to do, which it is, but because actually it could provide savings in the long run as well and take some pressure off of those other systems. Because, you know, I know correctional officers, you know, they're neither trained really or inclined temperamentally to be psychiatric care clinicians, you know, and the setting is really substandard. So I just think that's probably the biggest the elephant in the room is that you've got a lot of seriously mentally ill people who are incarcerated. Granted, those who've committed really violent crimes, they need to be there. I mean, I'm not saying let all the mentally ill people who are incarcerated out. I'm just saying there's a certain percentage of them, fairly big percentage, that are probably in for nonviolent crimes who really would be better served by being, you know, being managed in the community or a state hospital. So it's, you know, we just dodged a budget bullet here in San Francisco. We were on track to go from 40 acute inpatient psychiatric beds at our hospital, the county hospital in San Francisco, to 20. And it looks like, I've just heard today back at work, that those changes aren't coming, at least until the summer. So, but we've gone from 80 acute inpatient beds in San Francisco to 40 over the course of the last 3 or 4 years. And so, and, it, you know, it's economics. I mean, part of the problem is that inpatient psychiatry is a money loser for hospitals. This is also true in private insurance, private sector, that private sector is losing its taste for inpatient psychiatry because compared to other services, psychiatry is a money loser. So, you know, ICU beds in a hospital or medical surgical beds, labor and delivery, those are all services that are, you know, procedurally heavy and, you know, the reimbursement is good. So hospitals are saying, you know, we can't afford to have inpatient psychiatric units because it's a money, you know, it's a cost center as opposed to revenue. So it's complex. I think part of the problem is psychiatric care is labor intensive. It's complex. The outcomes are often unclear. And I think it's easy for people to say, well, that stuff doesn't work and we don't need that. And so that's where wishful thinking comes, that, you know, well, the system doesn't need to handle these patients because, you know, psychiatrists don't know what they're doing and that care doesn't work. And so, I mean, I just think it's been easy to sort of let, you know, let basically to neglect that sector of public health care.
Yeah. In our great debate over health care, has mental health been given any or much attention? Or
I don't know. You know, I maybe am cynical or lazy or both. I haven't really been following the details all that carefully. I mean, I do know that the mental health parity laws that have been coming through have been helpful overall, so that's been useful. But the way that the private sector handles mental health benefits is that they're just as aggressive at trying to get people out of the hospital in 3 or 4 days as the public sector is.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not, to be honest with you, I'm not all that confident that the new healthcare plan will do a better job of dealing with mental health issues. I think the mental health issues are on the table, though. I mean, my sense is they're not being neglected completely. And, you know, private insurers do offer mental health benefits on an outpatient and inpatient basis. So there definitely is still, the insurance industry is still there. I mean, I have been asked the question whether I think a single payer system would do a better job. And I actually think if run properly that a single payer system would do a better job with the sickest of the sick, the patients that we're seeing at San Francisco General Hospital. I mean, the reality is most of them are already being treated under Medicare, or which is a federal program, or Medicaid, you know, state health insurance for indigent and disabled people. So, I mean, already a lot of our patients are in the public health care system. So I think it's not perfect, but the structures are in place to provide care for seriously mentally ill in a public system. So I think a public option would be useful for mental health care.
Hmm. In those 40 psychiatric beds at San Francisco General, who are the people in those beds, and how long are they there?
Well, there's a subset of perhaps 20 or 30% that are seriously chronically mentally ill patients, many of whom will wait for 30 to 60 days to get longer-term locked care. And some of those patients actually will go to a subacute part of the hospital that is less expensive. Of the other sort of two-thirds, I would say, you know, probably 30% of the entire number are people who are what I would say recidivists, so people that we see really often that we see because they either do one of two things. One is they don't take their prescribed psychiatric medication. And number two, they use alcohol and drugs. And so we see a tremendous amount of alcohol and drug problems on the front door here. Probably at least two-thirds of patients come in under the influence of alcohol, but often methamphetamine, cocaine, and other drugs that cause changes in behavior. So there's a group who are essentially, after 3 or 4 days of being off alcohol and drugs and being back on their medications, they don't look too bad. So we send them back out. And so those are folks that may stay for 4 or 5 days. We send them out. They stop their meds. They drink. They smoke crack. And boom, they're back on my front door again. And often I have to admit them because they become absolute, you know, disorganized messes.
Yeah.
And then I say another third are people that we don't see that often. And I would say a lot of them have chronic sort of moderate illness, so people with severe depression, people with severe PTSD, post-traumatic stress, people with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder who've gone off their meds and just are very symptomatic from going off their meds, so people who have hallucinations or suffering delusions of paranoia or grandiosity and just you know, not taking care of things. Many of them are suicidal, and now sort of being potentially suicidal or potentially violent, that's one of the main criteria for getting admitted on an involuntary hold. So of the 40, they're all here against their will. I mean, at least on paper, some of them are okay with it, but they're all on involuntary holds pretty much.
Mm-hmm.
But the length of stay is, you know, drifted over the last 10 years, has drifted from 10 to 14 days down to under, you know, it's now under a week. And for the, you know, for the sickest patients, the ones, you know, who seem to be stabilized at day 4, I mean, most of them really would benefit from being back on their meds for 2 to 3 weeks in this kind of a setting. So, you know, whereas there's a wish to discharge people on day 4, day 5 to save money, the reality is if you held on to them for 10 to 14 days, you'd probably have a better chance long term that they wouldn't bounce back. And so, you know, though if that research has been done, I don't know it. But there's, you know, because we're under this sort of short-term budget pressure, everybody's looking with a short-term view, and, you know, and we get this recidivism going on. So, but so some of the people there, though, I mean, I will say are middle, upper-middle class people who are in the midst of a true crisis. And that's one of the nice things about working here. It's not just the homeless mentally ill. I mean, I certainly have those patients. But I also have patients really just like you or me or anybody else who, you know, working, has a family, and they either develop a severe psychiatric illness like bipolar disorder, or they have an overwhelming loss. So they may have loss of a job, death of a child, death of a spouse, and those losses precipitate them being suicidal or sometimes even psychotic. And, of course, those patients tend to, you know, they tend to get better because they have, their illness is not as severe, and they have resources. So when they leave here, they can see a psychiatrist,
mm-hmm.
and they have enough insight to continue on medication. So, I mean, I definitely get, you know, I would say it's maybe 10 or 15% of the population are people who have private insurance, and that's another sort of codicile, if someone has a private health plan, then we have to transfer them from here to a private hospital. So, you know, I don't see those people longer term, but I, you know, having worked in private hospitals, I know that many of them tend to do really well. This may be a one-shot deal, you know, and definitely see patients who are like, it's pretty clear when you sit down with them, it's like they're freaked out by being here. They've never been in a place like this. And you can see that it's not that likely they'll be back again. So it's like a true crisis. So, that, I mean, it's nice to have some higher functioning patients as well.
Yeah. We have a couple of callers waiting to talk with us. So let's go first to a listener in Effingham, Illinois, on line four. Good afternoon.
Yes, thank you very much. I have two questions. I'm wondering if your guest has ever read or heard of Wilhelm Reich, and that Mr. Reich was in the invention process of what was called later by another family, a hug box. And this was a part of Reich's treatment of the mentally ill. I don't know how it works. I never saw the patents or anything like that, but the reference to it is what put Reich into a federal prison where he died.
Mm.
But he was a brilliant man, and I have read several of his things now, and he was pointing a past Sigmund Freud.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it has all been very interesting to myself. If I can take your answer, I'm on the road today, but if I could take your answer now, can you answer?
Sure.
Okay, and we'll put you on hold then and let you go on your way. Okay. Paul Lindy?
So Wilhelm Reich, I've heard his name. I know the tradition to some extent. I actually haven't read any of his primary texts. What I do know is there are therapists who specialize in doing Reichian therapy and are influenced by his teachings. And kind of the most I can say about it is that I think that, you know, it does put sort of a more humane, compassionate spin on things, and that there was a need for this, you know, after Freud's theories came out, which really were in their heyday in the 40s and 50s here. So Sigmund Freud took more of a detached stance, a psychoanalytic stance, and that would let the process unfold, that the therapist would be relatively passive and neutral and not say much. And I think Reich, among others, came after Freud and decided that that sort of detachment might do more harm than good, and that I think was, you know, a necessary part of the development of psychotherapy training and practice to have people come to counterbalance that. So having said that, that's about as far as I can go, but I'm familiar with the tradition, and I think it, you know, it's added to the practice, particularly psychotherapy.
And did our Effingham caller want to follow up?
Well, just to ask again, does your guest know anything about the hug box? I watched this lady on C-SPAN for 4 hours one Sunday, and her parents had one, and they, to calm her down, and I don't know, have any idea how that worked, but it was used for, and she was highly literate in prizes, but she was autistic, I think.
Oh, this is Temple Grandin,
I think.
Yes, yes. Oh, Temple Grandin. Okay.
This is the squeeze chair.
Yes.
Oh, the squeeze chair. You know, I don't know anything about that, and it's not anything used in the hospital setting, but so Temple Grandin has, you know, a form of autism, a developmental disorder that starts in childhood. And it's interesting, we don't see very many autistic or Asperger's patients in the adult population here, but there is a, you know, theoretical thing that's very nice for that, in that the squeeze chair, I think, is a sense of sort of safe containment. You know, there's a nurturing aspect, but, you know, we do talk about containment, and there's Winnicott, among others, have talked about psychotherapy as being an emotional container. I think that this is a very tangible, you know, this is, a squeeze chair sounds much nicer than a wet blanket wrap or a straitjacket. I actually don't know much about it directly, but it, you know, it sounds like it, in use properly, actually has a lot of potential.
Yeah, I would say to the listener, go out and look for her books. She's written a number of books now, and it's interesting. She developed this squeeze chair or squeeze box for herself because it was very difficult for her for quite some time to be comfortable with the touch of other people.
Mm, okay.
And she also is in the business of designing livestock operations, and she's put this to work in terms of calming livestock. So very interesting. I want to thank the listener for his call. And
yeah, thanks.
Let's take another call, a listener in Chicago on line one. Hi.
Thank you. A couple of points. You say you like your job best when you're not there. Reminds me of our yoga concept of doing less is more, but it allows us opportunity to open up to many other areas. But going back in the social economic conditions we're having today, Emil Durkheim, 100 years or more ago, pointed out the displacement of the person when they're no longer in their professions and doing the things that we would normally expect normal things to be, and with the displacement in our employment situation and budget crisis and other things looming on the horizon like wars and so forth, it's no wonder that people are drifting and indulging and going off in whatever ways of or escape or so forth. Do you think we're all maybe heading towards a brave new world out there somewhere?
Well, that's a good question. It's a very kind of broad political, philosophical question. And, I do think as you're making your comments, I'm thinking that, if you're not depressed, you're not paying attention. I mean, right now we're in very turbulent times. And, I do feel that the uncertainty, budget uncertainty and then also political uncertainty, that it's hard to sort of stay sane and not be anxious and depressed in our current societal configuration. As for a brave new world, I think it's hard to say how this is all going to come out. I mean, I just sort of feel like we need to kind of keep doing the best we can and hanging on and see what happens, because a lot of these forces are far beyond, what any of us can control as individuals. And, it's interesting, turbulent times, and, being a parent, I have to say, is probably the most sobering aspect of this, is just trying to raise your kids in, stable times, now trying to raise them into a world that's so uncertain. I sort of feel for all of us. But, I guess I'm inclined to take an optimistic view and that things will work out. But, I might, it might be my own rose-colored glasses there instead of reality. So, yeah.
We're running down on time, and I did want to ask you about your experience in Zimbabwe.
Okay.
You wrote a book about this, Of Spirits and Madness, an American Psychiatrist in Africa. Mm-hmm. Can you just talk with us a couple of minutes about that experience and what you learned there?
Well, I learned sort of medically is that, at least in that culture, that people will incorporate into their psychotic symptoms whatever they're experiencing in their regular life. And there, people who became psychotic or got manic would attribute the appearance of those symptoms often to the spirit world. So whether it's your ancestor spirits, those who've gone before are influencing you, or else even witchcraft, and that sort of was a plausible way to explain the onset of psychiatric symptoms. I guess the other thing I learned beyond sort of the technical part is that get a sense of the resilience of the human spirit, and a sense that happiness doesn't come from material possessions, that it comes more from, I guess, internally, and that it comes from, somewhere that I don't know where, but that the Americans, I think, Americans have kind of gone off track with looking for happiness in material goods, and even looking for happiness in experiences, that, there's something about people who have less seem to appreciate what they have more.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's sort of trite, but having, experienced that for a whole year, I really got a sense that there's a lot of truth to that, that, affluence doesn't necessarily bring contentment. I mean, people there with really nothing, enough to eat, place to sleep, seemed much happier than most of a lot of the people I'm seeing here in San Francisco who, and I'm not talking about the people living on the street, I'm talking about middle, upper middle class people, that there's a certain sense of contentment that I think people who are in developing countries might have than we have. So.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting if you are at the checkout counter or you have a subscription to People magazine, you open the cover and you can see how much misery there can be there among people with great fame and great wealth.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. And that we're vicariously sort of, I guess we feel better about our own lives if, Brittany or you know, Justin or whoever else is
hit a rough patch.
Yeah. And I don't know. I'm sure we could go on and on about the influence of the mainstream media in propagating that, but probably a topic for another day, huh?
Yeah, probably. Well, that would be lovely to talk with you again.
Sure, I'd be happy to.
Okay. Dr. Paul Lindy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Celeste.
Paul Lindy is the author of Danger to Self, On the Front Line with an ER Psychiatrist. The book is published by the University of California Press.